Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our guests. One of our goals in life, or maybe our primary goal in life, is to find ways to develop a closer connection to Hashem in our ordinary life, and to bring God, the Ribono Shalom, into our everyday experiences, and to make that part of our, you know, when I say our life, meaning our consciousness. So perhaps one takeaway from this year, which maybe you would not expect from the Hakdamah of Bnei Yeshua, is to focus on that macro goal. And if we have that as a good takeaway, so then we'll have succeeded. If we do not, then maybe not. But maybe we'll have to, exactly, we'll have to get something else out of this. But that's the background, which is how do we take an experience in life, which is going to be very central to this Hakdama, and to the reason why the Pnei Yeshua wrote the Sefer, how do we incorporate that into our own lives, into our experiences? So that's the background. There was a very important thesis that was offered by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik in his seminal article in an essay that he wrote called Kol Dodi Dofek. So some are familiar with Kol Dodi Dofek because half of that work deals with the modern state of Israel and the six knocks that the Ribono Shel Olam knocked on our door, so to speak, with the founding of the state of Israel. That's probably the most famous part of this very long, it's like 50 pages, this essay called Kol Dodi Dofek. But there's another part of Kol Dodi Dofek. Just saying. That's it. Just saying. That's what happens after 10 years. Lost kind of time. Okay. So we're just getting started. So with Kol Dodi Dofek, the Rav has half the article, which is the lesser studied part, is about the Holocaust. And he has a very profound and very intense thesis there. But it's very helpful for many people dealing with many situations in their life. And I've heard this even in listening to some people, the following. Rav Soloveitchik develops this notion that there are two covenants. There are two aspects of being the Jewish people. One is what we would call fate, that's Goral, that we have a shared fate, we're all going to the same place. But then we have a Yud, we have a destiny. And that those are not exactly the same. One is forged in Yetzias Mitzrayim, the other is forged in Har Sinai, that's the background. And then he gives you the crucial point. He says, a person who is a person of fate asks, why? Why me? Why did this happen? Why now? They have a lot of why questions. And the Rav says that those questions are valid. Those are legitimate, valid questions. Usually on Tisha B'Av, that's the one day that's devoted to how to think about that question, why. But he says the problem is that with that question comes a very long and dark rabbit hole with very unsatisfactory answers. He says, what's going to happen at the end of that? He says, another line of questioning, the people who are of the destiny orientation, they ask a totally different question. They ask, what? What do I do now? What do I do with this circumstance? I've retold many times the very powerful experience that I had with someone who is known to some people in this room, who unfortunately was diagnosed with a very, very Rahman al-Islam, a very terrible illness. And when I first went to visit with this person, who was a young person, he asked a lot about why and why. And I was just sitting there listening. I'm a pisher. I don't know anything. But, you know, some people, it's important for them to have company. So I had the chance to keep him company. But then I noticed that as the months went on, he stopped asking why. I'm just listening. And I noticed that he starts asking, what? What am I going to do with this? What is my opportunity now? What's my challenge? So maybe I should go speaking. Maybe I should figure out how I apportion my tzedakah. A lot of interesting things, but it was a total shift. And as I listen to this, I'm thinking that is a development from a psychological standpoint. Dr. Rakovitz would probably say that when you talk about bereavement, there's a big process from going from passive to active. So when he used to talk about this when we would learn about bereavement and these kinds of dealing, he of course dealt with a lot of trauma. It really put those two together, that the what question is an active question. So he talks about how in their work, in their psychology work, let's say with children after traumatic events, they would have them do art projects or all kinds of things to get them active, to do something. That's what I think. I mean, the Rav doesn't speak in this terms, but I think that's what the Rav is saying, is that the halacha says you have to ask what? What do I do now? As opposed to a passive response is why? And it doesn't get a person out of bed in the morning. So the Rav says those are two different models. There's the why question, which we're not taking away. It's a valid question. And then there's the what question, which is the goal. So that's a thesis that we want to start with. That's going to color this discussion because, you know, most of the people in this room more than I think everybody here is older than I am, have much more life experience than I do. And everybody here has seen their fair share of those kinds of questions and navigating the why and the what, which is very complicated. But I think it's very useful. It happens to be that last year we shared this in the Holocaust Museum with a group of the docents, and it was very interesting to think about it with that group in that context of thinking about the why and the what. We had an entire session just on that one yesod that we summarized in 2 minutes.
The two questions are obviously interlinked, right? Your answer to the first can lead you in different directions for the second.
Exactly. So a lot of times but that can get muddy. As Paul is saying, the why and the what, you know, there's oftentimes a confusion about those in the sense of causation. Because sometimes you'll say, well, I'm going to attribute the why to something, and then that's going to drive my what. But if the causation, if the attribution is speculative, so then that's not so simple, you know, because how do we know why? You know, unless you're a prophet, how do you know why? You know, the Gemara says, Yifash Beish B'masav. Yifash Beish B'masav can be interpreted as, I'm going to search and figure out why this happened to me. And I'm quite confident that there are very pious people who are living at that level of the Ribbono Shel Olam is medaktik imam kechud asara, and they can actually attribute why it is. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in the biography, there's a beautiful art scroll biography of Rav Moshe where he tells a story that Rav Moshe had gone for some medical procedure, and the medical procedure failed. And he told his family afterwards, he says, I know why it failed, because I lacked my level of bitachon, my level of emuna, because of the way that I navigated. It was not on par with where I am, and I know that's why it failed. So maybe if you're the Gaon Hador, the great tzaddik, you're at that level, you can attribute to why. But the rest of us, you know, regular people, how do we know why? So that's where those two questions, if you link them too closely, you may end up in a complicated, sometimes even compromised position, rather than saying, well, why is this, and therefore that's going to drive my what, sometimes you could just say, I don't know why. I don't know. We've got to be able to live with questions. That's part of living in this world. That's why, and I'll just end this point on this one, Ha'ara, my rabbi, Rabbi Benjamin Yudin from Fairlawn, so he says that when you say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, you close your eyes. Why? Because Echad, Achduso Yisbarach, means both sides of the ledger. What we call good and what we call not good. It's all echad. So he says, you know why you close your eyes? Because in this world, it's hard to see that. It's hard to see echad. It's only by Yom Ahui Hashem echad u'shmo echad. Only at that time, lost level, we'll see it. So I want to put that out as the first ha'ara in terms of background for this hakdama. That this distinction is going to be very important. The difference between what and why. That's all. Okay. Base, unrelated, seem unrelated, but we'll get to why they're connected in a minute. You can imagine, for example, that there are two different employees in the village office who are responsible for the roads here in Skokie. When we move to, what's that? When we moved
here with the class.
I don't know what's going on. Maybe you have more insight than I do. I'm speculating right now. I have to ask the trustees. But I'm suspecting that this is the case. Because let's say a couple of years ago, when we lived on Sleeping Bear, two summers ago, they repaved the streets. Nice. Remember? It was good. I mean, we could drive there for a few months, but it was really, afterwards, it was great. So who was responsible for repaving our street? The village. The village paid for it with tax dollars, and they hired a company to repave the street. But who was responsible directly? So you could argue there were two people who were responsible. There is the village planner. So that's a guy I suspect. There's a guy who sits on Oakton in an office with a giant map. Or today they sit with a computer, they don't need a map. They sit with a map and they look at all the streets in Skokie. And they assess what are the main arteries and which ones belong to the village and which ones are cared for by Cook County, so they're not responsible for them. And where the water mains run and where the potholes are, and they look at all the different streets and they figure out how, well, this street intersects with that one, and if you affect this street, it's going to affect the traffic and how that's going to affect the children walking to school. They have a whole cheshbon of all the streets put together. I'm sure there's a guy like that, or two or three people, men, women, I don't know how many there are. They're there. That's one. And those people are responsible for paving the street. They decided that our little Timber Ridge subdivision, the potholes were so gefährlich after so many years that they just needed to repave it. And then the cheshbon, well, if you repave this part of the subdivision, it's going to affect that part, so they're going to decide next summer to do the next street, v'chule, v'chule. That's one person who's responsible for paving the street. And then you have the guy who, the sweaty guy with the big overalls with the coffee mug and he's sitting in the truck, who actually paves the street. You ever see? They have a crew. They come out there. It's a chevra. They have a whole system. They didn't just wake up that day to figure out how to pave a street. They have trucks, and they have cement and asphalt and all this. It's amazing. It's amazing. For someone who can't really put more than a screw in the wall, I'm always like Miss Ball from these guys. They know exactly where to pour and what's going on, and they make the sidewalk. It's very nice and smooth. It's amazing. It's great. Two different guys. You have the guy in the village, in the hall, and then you have the guy literally on the street who's paving it out to make sure that it's smooth. So, lahavdil elef alfei havdalos, these two people, we call them, in our world, we call them Tosfos and Rashi. Lahavdil, Rashi, he's the sweaty guy on the pavement. Rashi is the guy who gets down and he smooths out every crack on the page. That's Rashi's job. Rashi's just, he's hired, so to speak, to write a kuntris, to look at your page of that one daf gemara and make sure there are no cracks, that there are no bumps, there are no potholes. That's his job. Good? Rashi doesn't worry about it. He doesn't worry about what's going on south of Dempster. He doesn't worry about what's going on north of church. That's his job. He's the guy in the truck smoothing the page. That's it. Tosfos happen to be Rashi's grandchildren, but for this it's no matter. Tosfos says, no. You can't just smooth out one road. Well, how does this road impact what's going on three blocks away with the water main? You can't just worry about what's in front of your nose. You have to take all of Shas into consideration. Which is why when you open a page of Talmud, on the inside is Rashi's commentary, because he's older, he's preceding Tosfos. On the outside is Tosfos, and they have totally different jobs, and they have totally different styles and different goals. That's why their Perushim are totally different. You would never confuse the guy in the truck with the overalls with the guy wearing the suit in the village hall. They're totally not to be confused at all. Okay? But here's the unfinished business. That's a little bit not fair. because Rashi wrote his Pirish, he smoothed out all the cracks in the road, he gave us all, you know, it would be like, you know, reading Gemara without Rashi is like getting up in the morning and not putting on your pants. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't walk outside. You're just not shy. You can go out without a shirt, maybe. You can go in an undershirt if you have to run to Dunkin' Donuts or something. B'di'evet, b'shasat chagadol. You know, so you've seen this sometimes. People do that. They go. I've seen it. I've seen people come in a t-shirt to the Dunkin' Donuts. But no, lower lane, or nobody goes. It's like, without Rashi, you can't get anywhere in learning Gemara. Excuse the mashal. It's not shy. But the problem is, it's not fair. Because Rashi wrote his Pirish. The Tosfos come along, and they total demolish half of the things that Rashi said. They have no respect for their parents, grandparents, the bzyoidas. So what happens now? How do you resolve a lot of questions that Tosfos poses to Rashi? But Rashi dies in 1105. The Tosfos only get going 10, 15, 20 years later, and they go for another 200 years, the Baalei HaTosfos. It's a little unfair, no? So we have good news for you. Are you ready? This is it. Ta-da! The Pnei Yeshua. And that's the sefer we're going to focus on today. The Pnei Yeshua, which literally means the face of Joshua. The Pnei Yeshua is probably the most well-known sefer who makes it his business to attend, if not every Rashi, but almost every Rashi, to say, this is what Rashi says, this is what Tosfos says. Let me explain to you why Rashi wasn't so off the mark. And let me re-explain how Rashi, in his mind, learned this Gemara. He's not the first one to do it, as we'll see, but he's probably the most prominent. So when you have a problem with a Rashi, when you have a kasha from a Tosfos on a Rashi and you're not sure where to go, this is your destination. This Pnei Yeshua is your destination. So let's... Here. Oh, no, we're just about to get to that. Perfect. So let's get to when we're talking about over here. Yes?
Why is Tosfos called Tosfos?
Because they are...
We have
good.
Yeshua, you have Rambam.
Oh, great.
Why is Tosfos?
Good question. So what does the word Tosefes mean?
Addition.
Addition, exactly. So originally, you had a Gemara, and then they published Rashi. Rashi was written in Kuntresim, which is why when Tosfos has a comment on Rashi, it says, Pirush HaKuntres, it says in the pamphlet. So Tosfos is the addition to Rashi's commentary. That's why it's called Tosafos. Now, it happens to be that Rashi was one man. He was born in 1040, died in 1105. Tosfos, maybe the most important Bala Tosfos, Rabbi Nutam, that was Rashi's grandson. Rabbi Nutam dies in 1171. But Tosfos, they represent a school of thought. This mashal that we gave about the street paver and the guy in the... That guy in the village office, he's using what's called the dialectic model. He's comparing, taking different places in Shas and putting them together and asking a question and then resolving it, which is why the Rabbi Nutam was a revolutionary learner. He came up with new halachas that didn't exist in areas, let's say in Spain, where they were not using the dialectic method initially before the Rabbi Nutam's method filtered down there. He had new ideas, because if you have to compare a Gemara in Sukkah and a Gemara in Shabbos and you compare them and you have to ask a question, well, the way you resolve that contradiction may result in some new idea. And that was a tremendous chiddush, but that went on for a few hundred years. Till around the year 1300.
So was it one location?
So it's also a good question. So we generally refer to it kind of as one general base medrash. There was the Rabbi Nutam had a colleague, the Reed, Rabbi Yitzchak of Dampier. Rabbi Nutam lived in Rouen. Let's step back a second. Rashi lived in Troyes. I have to be makir tov to my parents because... I hope they're still not paying this bill, but in addition to sending me to college and graduate school, they also sent me for a summer for a couple of weeks to study Jewish history in France. So I actually went through, Rashi has this, there's a little monument in this tiny French town. There's no Jews there. There are French peasants there. It's a city northeast, about 40 minutes by train from Paris, called Troyes, T-R-O-Y-E-S. That's where Rashi lived. Not far from there is a city called Rouen, which is Rabbeinu Tam. R-O-U-E-N. And then the Re, Rabbi Yitzchak, lived in Dampierre. And then he had several students. One of them was Rabbi Eliezer of Metz, which is further east, not far from Germany, depending on what day it is. It was either France or Germany. In Alsace. There was a very important Balatosis, the Rash, Rabbi Shimshon of Shans. We call it Shans, but in French it's Sens, S-E-N-S. So they all lived in this area, the suburbs of Paris. There was a very famous Balatosis who lived in Paris, who was involved in the disputation in the 13th century, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris. Paris is Paris, if you didn't just translation sake. So this is referred to as the Chachmei at Tsarfas. They had this entire revolutionary school which filtered down to their Talmidim, which even extended into Ashkenaz. All right, one more historical tidbit. Had it not been for Rashi's Beis HaMedrash, we probably would not have any Ashkenazi Jewry in terms of halachic creativity, in terms of limud. Because think about it, Rashi studied in Worms. Worms is in Germany. But the Worms, the Rhine communities, what happened to them?
Crusade.
That's right. They all were demolished, totally smashed by the Crusades. But Rashi was spared because Rashi was back near Paris. So Rashi has a whole world of learning which is being created by Rashi and then the Balei HaTosfos, while in the Rhine Valley, everything had been destroyed. Before Rashi came along, there was no learning. I mean, some learning, but there was no learning in France. All the learning was in the Rhine Valley. Was in Speyer, Mainz, Worms. These are the Kehilos Shum. This is where it was all at. This is where Rabbeinu Gershom, that's where all the learning was going on. And then it kind of swung, the pendulum swung over to this area that we call Tsarfas, the environs of Paris. And then, so it's going to swing back a little bit. And the last of the great Balei HaTosfos was Maharam of Rothenburg, Rabbeinu Meir of Rothenburg. You could argue that he was the last of the great Balei HaTosfos. He dies, well, first, some of you are familiar, he was captured. He tried to escape from anti-Jewish persecution in Germany, and he was captured by a snitch. He was sent to the government, and he spent 7 years. He died in prison. He didn't want to be ransomed. His body was spent 7 years before he was ransomed, and then he's buried in Worms in the cemetery there. But after that, then they didn't really have much learning because the Russian, they escaped from Germany. They moved to Vienna. Anyway, that's a longer story, but that's why they're called the Tosfos, because they're additional commentaries on the Gemara in addition to Rashi. Now, this is separate from everything that's going on in Spain and the Rabbeinu Hananel and the Rimigash. That's two totally different worlds. They're not going to meet until the Ramban, which is not going to be until the 13th century. Okay? So the job of the Pnei Yeshua is going to be to defend Rashi. Where is the Pnei Yeshua living? Let's get to this question. So in 1680, the Pnei Yeshua is born in Krakow. He had a grandfather whose name is Rabbi Yeshua Heschel, also his name is Yeshua. His grandfather wrote a sefer called Magine Shlomo. Interesting title, Magine Shlomo. What does the word Magain mean? Yes, Shlomo. Who is, what's that?
It's Rashi.
Bingo. Yes. The grandfather of the Pnei Yeshua also wrote the Magine Shlomo. He was the first one, as far as I know, maybe someone before, but I never heard of it. He was the first one to do a systematic defense of Rashi against Tosfos. So his grandson, and we'll see why in a little bit, his grandson decides, I'm going to do the same thing like my Zeta. My Zeta wrote a sefer that was about defending Rashi called the Magine Shlomo. I'm going to do the same thing. Magain is the shield of Shlomo. He's going to defend Rashi against the assault, the limud of Tosfos.
Why did he have to if his grandfather already did?
Because it wasn't exhaustive. So there's a lot more to be said. And the truth is, since the Pnei Yeshua, there's been countless attempts at different Pirushim, how to explain, because the Pnei Yeshua is one pshat and others will give more and more. So he's born in 1680. He becomes a Rav in some small towns, and then he becomes a Rav in a very prominent city in Poland called Lemberg, that we call Lvov. He takes over from another very, very prominent, important Talmud Chacham. Before him, the Rav in Lemberg was none other than the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Ashkenazi, who became afterwards the Rav in Amsterdam, one of the preeminent poskim of the 17th century. So he takes over the Chacham Tzvi in Lemberg. Then he becomes for a couple of years a Rav in Berlin. So he's moving westward from Poland to Berlin. Then from Berlin he moves to Metz. Metz is in that Alsace-Lorraine area, also very, very prominent, very important Jewish city. Some of the greatest Rabbanim over the last 400 years have been the rabbis in Metz. Before him was the Shvus Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Reischer, and then later after him, in the end of the 18th century, was the Chagas Aryeh. The Chagas Aryeh was one of the greatest luminaries of Eastern Europe, lived at the same time as the Vilna Gaon. He was the Rav in Metz. One of my favorite stories about the Chagas Aryeh, my grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, had a friend, a very close chaver, his best friend in the world, who was a professor, brilliant Talmud Chacham, named Rabbi Dr. Meyer Hershkowitz. Rabbi Hershkowitz made Aliyah long before I was born, in the early 1970s. When he made Aliyah, he owned 7,000 svarim. So when I met him, he was 90 when I learned in Israel, in KBY, and I used to go and visit him. My grandfather died when I was right before my bar mitzvah, so he was gone. But my grandmother, Zichrona Livracha, they were very, very close. So I went to visit him. So he told me, he says, you always have to have a project in your life. He was a Holocaust survivor. Most of his family had been killed, but he had one brother. He said, my brother was a taxi driver, and then when he had to retire, he died not long after that because he didn't have a project. He says, you always have to have a project. He was, at that time, he was 90. So he said, I told the Rabbona Shel Olam that as much time as he'll give me, I'll always have a project. So he was working on his fifth sefer. He was very frail. So he would go to take a taxi, or someone would drive him to the library. Two librarians would carry him up in a wheelchair and put him at a desk, and they would bring him the svarim he needed, piles of svarim, and that was how he learned every day. That was how he worked. And he told me he should always have a project. Because he told me that the Chagas Aryeh was 70 years old. He was extremely, he lived in abject poverty his whole life. The Chagas Aryeh was one of the Gaonim, great, great genius of the last 1,000 years. So they used to say, what's the difference between the Vilna Gaon and the Chagas Aryeh? They'd say, 25 miles. That was the level you're talking. But the Chagas Aryeh, he didn't have anything. So he decided, he heard that there was a position open, the Rav of Metz. So he says he's going to apply. So they sent a delegation of Metz to meet the Chagas Aryeh. They never heard of this rabbi who's living in Poland. So they send a delegation. They come, they knock on the door. They see 70 years old. They said, excuse me, Rabbi, we have a whole vibrant kila. How long are you going to, I don't want to say, but let's be honest over here. So the Chagas Aryeh apparently said to them, he said, look, how long do you expect to hire a rabbi for? So they said, 20 years. He says, 20 years I can give him, no problem. He was hired, and he died at the age of 90. Yeah. 20 years he was the Rav in Metz. Metz was very, very prominent. And then after Metz, he became a Rav in Frankfurt. Of course, everybody's heard of Frankfurt. He got involved in a very big controversy, which is far beyond the scope of today's discussion. The controversy between Rav Yonason Eibeshitz and Rav Yaakov Emden about Sabbateanism and whether or not Rav Yonason Eibeshitz was one of the greatest Gaon Hador, Gracie Uplasi, the Aras Davash, whether he was a secret follower of Shabbosai Tzvi. So this was the biggest thing since sliced bread. All across Europe, all the great Rabbanim, it was terrible, terrible controversy. So he was involved in this controversy. He dies in 1756. Okay? This is when he's living. Yes.
So before you said, okay, so this is all of this France and eastward sort of swirl that comes back. But before you also said that somewhere around 1200, the Spanish part became combined.
Let me clarify just for one second on one foot, literally half a foot, because otherwise we'd be here for at least 2-3 hours, which is okay, but people have things to do.
Have a project.
That's right. That's why I'm still here. Imagine two worlds living at the same time, parallel to each other. You have the world of Tsarfas, of France. Most of these families originated in Germany, Ashkenaz and Tsarfas. Many of them had come from Italy. Most famous family is called the Colonimus family. They came, they settled in the Rhine Valley. That's one world. You have another world. That's the world of Spain, of the Iberian Peninsula, of Morocco, of Fez. It's a whole other world. That most of these traditions originate in Babylonia and Babel. There was a legend of four captives, Rav Chushiel, Rav Hananel, the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. There's two worlds that are living together. At one point, let's say in the middle of the 13th century, these two worlds start to interface with each other. In between, there is a little section called Provence, the southern crust of France. So through Provence, Torah starts to filter in both directions. So let's say in the north, Hagos Maimoni was a student of the Maram of Rothenburg. He gets a hold of the Rambam. Opens up a whole new world. He starts writing glosses. And then the Ramban, he, from his teachers, Rav Nosson ben Meir of Trinquetai and others, they start, in Spain, they start to learn about the Tosfos and the kinds of questions the Tosfos are answering. So the Rashba and the Ritva, these students, so there is a cross-pollination going on. That's one piece of the discussion. There's a separate issue, which is a sociological and a migration question, which is that in 1306, for the 75th time, the Jews were expelled from France and expelled from, you know, a lot of these Western European countries, so they start to migrate. They're going farther west. So after the 14th century, you're not going to see much halakhic creativity in France ever. It's pretty much done. They're going to migrate. That's why there's a serious migration. So by the 16th century, the Ashkenazi Jews are all living in Poland. They're all migrating. They're going to stay a little bit in Vienna. They're going to stay a little bit in Germany. And they're going to go to Poland. They're going to start migrating. And the same thing is going to happen in Spain. Because at the end of the 15th century, Zeu, Nigmara Sipur, so everyone has to leave. And they're going to migrate to Tzfat and Egypt, North Africa, other places. So there are two different issues here. There's the development of the halacha, of the learning, and then there's the question of the migration, which are obviously interlinked.
So this may not just be an apologist between Rashi and Tosfos.
Well, he's definitely, I'll take exception to that term. He's not an apologist. He's trying to get into the mind of what was Rashi thinking when he learned the sugya, because he was aware. Rashi knew all the different sugyas. So what was Rashi thinking when he explained the sugya? Yeah, anyway, continue.
That's actually the original meaning of apology.
Okay, good. Yeah, so I'm glad.
But it would also be then influenced by that cross.
Yes. So this sefer, particularly, I don't believe is hugely influenced in a big way by the Sephardic tradition. But yes, absolutely. After the 13th century into the 14th century, now there's a much greater influence in both directions. So you'll find Sephardic poskim, Sephardic meshivim, Sephardic mefarshim, who are thinking like a Tosfos. The Rambam never had a Tosfos thinking cap. He didn't wear one. He never had one. And the Rabbeinu Tam never wore a thinking cap like the Rambam. He never classified or codified everything. But over time, and that's why today we have a synthesis between those two. And then to the extent that different mefarshim utilize those different approaches. So if you remember a couple weeks ago when we talked about the Beis Yosef, what was his goal? Was to bring it all together. And we did point out, if you remember, the Beis Yosef said, how am I going to decide? He says, I'm going to follow the majority of the big three. The Rosh, the Rambam, and the Rif. The problem was, we pointed out, that two of those three are Sephardic. So that's why he ended up with Sephardic Psak for the Beis Yosef, for Maran. That's why Sephardim follow the Shulchan Aruch. That's why they follow the Ashkenazi, the Sephardic tradition. So this is all a background to this Hakdama that the Pnei Yeshua writes to his Sefer. Now, the Pnei Yeshua's Hakdama that you're looking at in front of you is printed in the front of this volume, which is the first one on Brachos. But it was not written on Brachos because that was not the first one that he wrote. He wrote first on Ksubas, Gittin, and Kedushin in 7. It was published in 739. But he says, I'm going to tell you why I wrote this sefer. He says, first, I'm going to thank God, line number one, Ode Hashem Ma'od B'fi U'Besoch Rabbi Mahalalenu. I'm going to thank God. This Hakdama is replete with rabbinic and biblical poetic verses. So for those who are more familiar with that Hebrew, you're going to find a lot of beautiful references. So this is already a Tehillah reference. I'm going to thank God for all the things that he did for me. and I'm going to explain to you why I wrote this sefer. I want to focus specifically line number 6 on Limud Iyon HaTorah Lishma. I want to focus on learning in depth, and I bemoan the fact, he says, that people are not learning adequately, they're not learning seriously enough, so I'm going to write this sefer to help inspire people to learn. Why am I writing the sefer? He tells you something mamash unbelievable. Line 12. Va'achas shehihena, which is a rabbinic reference to Gemara in Shabbos. Kibalti alai l'chova, I accepted upon myself as an obligation. V'nadarti, and I took a neder bedover hanader, that's another rabbinic expression from Maseches Nedarim. Be'is tzarasi, in my day of trouble. This is what we call in halacha a neder be'is tzara, a vow in the time of distress. Who makes a vow at the time of distress? Anybody know? Can you think of a Tanakh figure?
Chana.
What's that? Chana. You could call that a neder be'is tzara. Yeah. Who else? In the Chumash, anybody? Vayidar Yaakov neder lemor. Yaakov is on the lamb. And he says to Ribbono Shel Olam, if you take care of me, if you bring me home, I'll repay my debt of gratitude. And later, Chazal invoked that same model of Neder Be'is Sara, that same model when Aaron dies. If you remember, Aaron dies, according to Chazal, the Anani HaKavo disappear. And the Kanani descend on the Jews living at that time in the desert. And they have a big struggle, and it says, Vayidar Yisrael Neder. They took a Neder, and they said, we promise the Ribbono Shel Olam will do this and such if we get out of this unscathed. That, Chazal say, is another example of a Neder Be'is Tzara. A person is in a time of great, of acute stress, so they cry out to the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Tefillah Be'is Tzara is a mitzvah d'oraisa, and it's not just a Tefillah, it's a commitment. It says, the Ribbono Shel Olam, if I get out of this, I'll commit to do the following. That's the concept. So he says, I, the Pnei Yeshua says, I did this. I made a neder be'ez tzara. What happened? Biyom charon af Hashem. Another biblical reference. What is it? Yom Gimel, Kislev. The third of Kislev. Winter, Shnas, Taksag, Lefimis Farkatan, Bekila Kedosha Levav. What year is that? 1702. 1702, he says, I'm living in Lvov. Sholev Hayisi Bevesi. I was calm. I was living in my house. Everything was fine. Viranan Behechali. Im Chavirim V'talmidim Hamakshivim L'koli. I had a yeshiva. We had Bachrim. We were learning. Everybody was good. Life was fine. Upesa Pisom. Suddenly, Haisa Meir. The city went from being a city, legal. Hafucha kumorega. Kumorega. In an instant, the city went from being a city to a heap of rubble. There was a gunpowder explosion and a fire in the city, in Lemberg. He says, Lo cholu bo yadayim v'kol zava lo shamanu ki im kol havara. We only heard the sound of, what's havara? Burning. We only heard burning. And he uses the phrase lechalik, yatzasa lechalik, it went out to divide, which is a phrase from the Gemara Maseches Shabbos, a rabbinic turn of phrase. He's using it poetically to say the place was mamish on fire. Umari esh hagedola, line 16. There was a huge fire. Uvehamislach kachas asher olo ba'amanosenu b'chaloneinu al Yedei kama chavios gedolos benoros, through many containers, maleim fulver. Fulver, that's powder, gunpowder, that exploded. Shahaya l'sreifas eish, line 18, 17. Achenersu habatim imigurosam, that the houses were lit up, destroyed. Kama batim gedolim ubitsuras choma ad l'shamayim, strong built houses. Smashed, raised. Hushbilu ad la'afar 19. Aru ad ha'yesodba. V'nerga, kivnergu kishisha u'shloshim nefashas kedoshas. 36 Jews were killed. And whom among them? Ubisoch HaChalolim, among those who were killed, Gamkein, Megare Besi Zu Ishti HaRishona Nishmasa Eden, my first wife, and her mother, Va'avi Ima, and her grandfather, Ad Shehigia Gamkein Letzaras Habas, to the suffering of the daughter. Tzaras Habas is a rabbinic phrase, which he says, what he's using, that's a play on words to talk about his own daughter. He says, Biti haktana achas hoysa li'ima v'chaviva alai b'yeser seis, my beloved, cherished daughter, was killed in this explosion. V'gam anochi, I was there, hayisi min hanefila me'igra rama labira amikta. I fell, that's an expression, from the roof to the floor. Ubasi be'imke mitzula be'eretz hatach tismamish. I fell into the ground. Kibisoch ha-machbeish machbas kovid masa ha-gale galim shenofalai koriz be'esenu. Because of the piles of wood that fell from our house on top of me, I felt like I was under a wave of wood. I was crushed, says the Pnei Yeshua. Lonisanuni, line 24, Hashi Ruchi Yodai Ve'ivari Enem Bershusi, my arms and legs were not under my control anymore. I was trapped. Amarti, I said to myself, Nigzarti Bidmeyamai Elcha Pukdosi Yaser Shnosai Lo Abit Adam Mod. I said, I'm going to die. I will not see people anymore. I know for sure this is where I'm going to die. As a young man, remember, he was 22 years old. He says, I'm for sure going to die. And when Misyari, line 26, I was afraid, Shalo Yaseh Besi Kivri, Leniskolim V'Lenisrafim L'Nirogim Olai Hayu Chulana. He says, I'm suffering here, I'm going to die. All the four Misos Bezdin. Only a rabbi would think like that. How am I going to die? Skila, Sreifa, Hereg, Chenek. That's what he's thinking. Okay. It's a rabbinic, morbid perspective, I guess. That's what he's thinking. He says, I'm going to die in my own house, all the Arba Mises Bezdin. He's saying, under the rubble. And then, what happens? Amnam, line 29. Bechemlas Hashem alai. Hashem had his mercy on me. Lo nesanani Elokim lahara imadi. God didn't allow it to do evil to me. Ukmo erech shlisha revia shah achar sheshakat v'sar mizaf kol hamapala. About 15-20 minutes after it quieted down from everything crashing, all of a sudden, rak adayin shifas kol hamulas hamol alav mervos. You hear people screaming, but you don't hear the collapsing buildings anymore. V'rabim asher himisu b'remisasim yosham asher b'rishona. And then all of a sudden, people are screaming, they're running, they're trying to save people. More people are getting trampled and smashed under the things. Sof davar, you won't believe what happened. Line 34, Yatsasi mechlal vadai sakonas lidei safek. Things quieted down and I realized, I'm not for sure going to die. Maybe I'm going to die. I might not die. And here I am. Oz, key line, number 34. Amarti, I said, Odeni b'soch hagal, I'm still under the pile of rubble. I said, Im ye Elokim imadi. Where is he paraphrasing from? Yaakov Avinu. He says, if the Rabbono Shel Olam will help me. V'hotziani min hamokom hazeh l'shalom. V'yivne li bayis ne'mon laharbos gvuli b'talmudim, b'talmidim. And he will bring me back to life. And give me a house, a place to live, and give me my talmidim. We should have students in the yeshiva. Lo emna atzmi mikos li beis hamedrash. I will not prevent myself. I will totally invest myself fully in just learning in the beis medrash. V'lishkod al dalsi ha'iyun besugias hashas and poskim, and to invest myself in the sugias of shas and poskim. V'lolam ba'omke shal halacha af linos harbi be'inyan echad, and I'm going to be very focused. And even if it means many nights on one topic, I'm going to devote myself to real learning, to a new level of intensity and devotion to my Talmud Torah, like I never had before, says the Pnei Yeshua. And what am I going to do? I'm going to follow the ubeze chashka nafshi lelech beikvos avosai avi imi rab sagona manoach moragolo rab yushazal. I'm going to follow in the ways of my grandfather. If I come out of this and I live, I'm going to be like my Zeta. You know this great Rabbi Yehusha, the Avbezin of Krakow. Everybody knows that he was miyashiv all the kashas from Rashi, on Rashi from Tosfos. Says, if I get out of this, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to go home. I'm going to rebuild the yeshiva. I'm going to rebuild my life, and I'm going to do exactly what he did. Sefer number 40, line 40. Sefer Megine Shlomo liyashiv kushas atosfos al Rashi, and that's what I'm going to do. And what happens? Line 43. Ani terem achale ledaber. I didn't finish speaking. Ledaber alibi. Shama Hashem bekol onyi. V'nosan li mahalchem bein ha'omdim. K'min shvil mamish. God opened a path for me that I was able to escape. V'yatzasi b'sholom b'liv pega v'chevel lo havabi. I got out of there and I was not even injured. Oz yodati ne'mona ki me'ashem ha'yadavar, that I knew that this was from God, mamish, b'makom she'in matzilun u'me'oz halo, he'samti ha'dvar me'libi. And from that time, samti ha'dvar me'libi, I took it to heart. And I did it. She'ikar limudi b'dvar halacha v'sugis ha'shas poskim, and I'm not going to talk about drush, I'm not going to give sermons, I'm just going to delve into the eon of the halacha, just like my grandfather. And from that, he says, I began this work, the Pnei Yehoshua. So you skip down.
He's 21.
22, yeah. Could you imagine? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So I want to skip the next section because we're running a little bit late. He says, it took me a couple of years. It happens to be, he says, there were a lot of people who were printing Svarim. These Svarim weren't even so good. And I finally got myself together. I really want to write on Brachos. I want to write on Moed. I want to write on Nezikin. But we have a Chabura, my Talmidim. We have our Limud. So we decide, we ended up learning the first. We learned three Masechtas and Nashim. So those are Ksubas, Gittin, and Kiddushin. So that's what we're going to write on first. And then he has a little Kuntras at the end. He says, with a condensed version of his conclusions, he says, this is what I'm going to write. What is he going to call his sefer? So you see at the bottom in the gigantic letters, you see on the left side, line 85, Karasi b'shem achibra kol im suge sashas, Pnei Yehoshua. Why did I call it Pnei Yehoshua? Why do you think he calls it Pnei Yehoshua? Because his name is Yaakov Yehoshua. Yehoshua, European, in Yiddish, the nickname was Yosha. So that's why he spelled it Yosha, but his name was Yehoshua. Pnei is the face of. So Masbir Panim Bahalacha, the face of the Halacha, that's why he's going to call it that. But he has a modification. Because his grandfather also wrote responsa. Responsa are chuvas, letters back and forth. His grandfather's chuvas were called Pnei Yehoshua. Because his grandfather also was named Yehoshua. This was his maternal grandfather, the famous Megine Shlomo. So he says, I also want to call it Pnei Yehoshua, but I'm going to call it a modified version of Pnei Yehoshua, which I did not know until I read this Hakdama. Third line later, he says, I'm going to call it Ape Zutri. Ape Zutri is a Gemara term for small face, little face. My grandfather was the Pnei Yehoshua, the response of Pnei Yehoshua. He was the big Pnei, I'm the little one. But isn't that a beautiful, like he's deciding to lead his life. He's even calling his name after the same. So don't be confused. If someone stops you in the hallway and says, have you seen the Pnei Yehoshua in the library? You'll have to say to them, which one? The Chuvas Pnei Yehoshua, which was the grandfather, or the Chidushim of the Pnei Yehoshua, which is the grandson? Don't let him off. You got to set the record straight so it shouldn't be confusing.
I'm sure glad I said here.
That's right. So then he goes to the next page. Take a look on the next page. He says, I'm going to give you the best that I can do to answer up top line. Mashinicha Tosis Pekusha. Maybe sometimes Tosis had a kasha. They didn't have a good answer for it. And I'm going to explain it. And then he gives you a beautiful apology. He says, look, everything in life, it's not perfect. There are mistakes. I'm praying to Hashem, you should help me. And if you find any mistakes, let me know. It's all okay. I'm not. In line 13, it says, "Don't think everything is perfect here. You're going to take my pshat in Rashi. You like it? Kazunta, hey, you don't like it? Find a better pshat. That's part of learning. So my job is I'm trying to go deep to really understand the halacha the best I can figure out.
If I don't give you the good shot, there's no problem. You come up with your own shot.
I'm a nobody, he says. But part of what we learn from the Ramban is that even though I don't think that I'm such a big Talmud Chacham, I have to try the best that I can. So he says, that's what he said later on the end of the first column. He says, I have to apologize. I'm going to be Miss Not Sale. I'm going to apologize that maybe my Sefer is not so good. What do I know? You know, I'm doing the best that I can. So this humility, which we've seen in other Hakdamas, is also here in the same Pnei Yeshua, where he says, on the one hand, I'm going to do my best. On the other hand, I don't pretend to be like the world's sole arbiter of the Pirush of Rashi to get an answer against Tosfos. Then on the top left column, he says, thank you to all the people, and he prays to Hashem, that Hashem should help him in the Sefer, in Ne'um Hatzor, conclusion. What does he say? This is Halo Kod Varai Zeira, the tiny letters at the end of the paragraph. Dimin Chavraya Ud Hamutzal Me'esh. He refers to himself as an Ud Mutzal Me'esh. What does that mean? A brand saved from a fire. You notice, who are oftentimes referred to as Ud Mutzal Me'esh over the last 85 years? That's right. It's the same phrase. Why is he using that phrase? Because he says he was in the gunpowder explosion. He's literally in Ud Mutzal Me'esh. Ne'um Hatzor Yaakov Yusha Ben La'adoni Avi Mori V'Rabi Harav Rav Tzvi Hirsch Zecher Tzadik Levracha L'chai Ha'olam Haba. That is the Pnei Yeshua Tzadik. So we go back to where we started. We started with 2 points. The second one was understanding the difference between Rashi and Tosfos. Tosfos' job is to reorient you so that you keep all of Shas in mind. And we said, who's going to help Rashi after Tosfos demolished so many Rashis? So we said, don't worry, you have the Megina Shlomo and you have the Pnei Yeshua. But before that, we had the basic point, Rav Soloveitchik's why and what. So this is a very concrete, powerful example where you have a man who's a young man, he's 22 years old, he loses his wife and his mother-in-law and his daughter, and his whole world collapses. His whole world is destroyed.
Literally,
exactly. And what does he decide to do? He decides, I'm going to take a project. I'm going to make what out of it? And he says to Rebbe Shem, he says Beferish, he says to him straight in the eye. He says, God, this is horrible. It's terrible. It's destruction of my whole life. But I'm gonna rebuild.
Kind of skip the why.
Yeah.
Jump right to the what.
Exactly. Now, I don't know how long it took him before he wrote this Hakdama to be in that place where he could write that observation. But you could see, even just in the moment, what was he focused on? He's focused on, what am I going to do next? If the Rebbe Shalom takes me out of here, where am I going to go?
How long did it take him to write? Or how old was he?
The first Chidushim were published in 1739. Those are these three on. And then this was on the last... were published in 1752, and he dies in 1756. So he's...
Didn't get a new project.
Well, he got as many projects as Rav Shalom gave him. That's what we all get. As many projects as he gives us.
But there is the why. I mean, he was focused on the what.
Yes.
You know, why? So that he could live. Because he felt by making this neder at that time, Rav Shalom would save him.
Right.
Starts with why, and yeah. If they are a little more advanced, they go to the why.
So the question, I wouldn't say advanced, I would say it's probably different times in our life and different cycles and different places, but I'm saying there's the why question of why did this happen to me? He doesn't ask. He doesn't say why. Right? He doesn't talk about it. Right? He doesn't talk about it.
Well, the fact that he made the neder at that time,
yes.
He was buried under the rubble.
Yes.
Right? He wanted to live.
Yes. And oh, for sure.
This was...
Oh. Yes.
Say, so he didn't make that after he said.
Right. He made it b'shas ma'isa be'is sarah mamish. Right.
Yeah.
So the why here, you know, because there's the why do I want to live? Yes. But I was talking more about the why. You know, what's the cause of this, which we don't know, and we don't know how he struggled with that or where it came from, or how he dealt with it. But this is all of this is where I wanted to start with from the first observation as the background, which is. If the Ribbono Shel Olam is real in our life and we're close to him, then that is the kind of response that a person can have. That to me might be the biggest takeaway of this whole Hakdama. more than the idea of Rashi and Tosfos, and more than the fact that he was focused on what he's going to accomplish and not dwelling on why it happened to him. It's the idea that the Ribbono Shel Olam was so real to him that they had a conversation. That he's sitting there, literally, under a pile of rubble, and he's telling the Ribbono Shel Olam, look, if I ever get out of here, this is going to be my plan, and I'd like you to please help me. That Ribbono Shel Olam was so real, and that is what we're ultimately trying to develop. We're trying to develop our closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that even if we can't answer the questions of why did this happen? Why did the Ribbono Shel Olam do this to me? Why did the Ribbono Shel Olam do this to us? But to still be in that relationship where we're with the Ribbono Shel Olam together. So even if we don't know why he's doing this or he's allowing this to happen to me, but we look at him and we say, ah, oh, Ribbono Shel Olam, I have to tell you, I'm so broken, or I'm so happy, or I'm so grateful, or I'm so scared, that kiviyachol, so to speak, we're with him, and he's with us. That, to me, was the most powerful takeaway of this whole thing. And isn't that what we're really striving for? We're striving to live at that level, that the Ribbono Shel Olam is mamish a part of our lives. That, I think, is, to me, the most powerful takeaway from this whole Pnei Yeshua, that that was how he oriented his life. And to me, that's the biggest takeaway, that we should grow in a way that whatever happens in our lives, whether we can answer the why questions or whether we can even answer the what questions, the main thing is that the Ribbono Shel Olam should be a part of that. We should be a part of it with him. We should be on that journey together.
You should follow through on what you promised.
And that's also true. You see how he takes him a couple of years.
There's no atheist in the front of it. He actually followed through.
Yes. That's what he says. Nasati alibi. Exactly.
You can't make empty promises, and that's the lesson.
Right? What is that, the joke with the guys on the plane, with the parking spot? No need, God, I found one, right? That's the parking spot joke. So that's it, exactly. But if it's a real relationship, then avada we follow through, because it's real. And hopefully, as we grow, we'll be able to continue to foster that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Thank you all for coming.